Great. So thanks very much for the introduction. And thanks, everyone, for coming. The weather has turned nice in Toronto and here as well this week, which is nice. But what better way to celebrate than by sitting in a windowless room for an hour? Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some recent work we've been doing at CETA on the prospect of measuring gravitational lensing of line intensity maps in the same way that you would do with the CMB, temperature and polarization, but using those tools and applying them to this new kind of observation. And I'll tell you what exactly is involved in this line intensity map technique in a second. But I should mention this work is mostly based on a paper that we posted on the archive about a month ago. So if you'd like more details, all the details you could ever want are in this paper. But I'll try and just hit the highlights in this talk. So the motivation for thinking about this is cosmology and what we can learn about cosmology from gravitational lensing. But just to start with a little review, so this is a cartoon of what gravitational lensing is. The main idea is that photons do not travel along straight Euclidean paths in general as they fly across the universe. If a photon passes by some distribution of mass or grazes some gravitational potential, its path will generally be bent. And if it passes through a very deep region of this potential or very close to some mass distribution, then the deflection will be quite severe, which is the case in this cartoon. So in this case, you might actually see multiple images of the same source of these photons when you look on the sky, or you might see some crazy distortion into an arc or a ring on the sky. And this is what's known as strong lensing. And this can be used in some circumstances in cosmology, but typically we're interested in the opposite weak lensing limit, where the deflections are very small and it might distort the observed shape of a galaxy or the observed size of a galaxy by a percent or two. And so galaxy by galaxy, this is a very hard effect to detect. But if we look at large areas of the sky, we can try and tease out the statistics of all of these deflections and use those statistics to learn something about the lower redshift lenses, these gravitational potentials that are actually doing lensing. One nice thing about lensing in cosmology is that it provides a direct tracer of these low redshift structures that are acting as the lenses. Basically, for a single lensing screen, such as the CMB, you get a line of sight projection over all of the gravitational potentials that are between you and the screen. And you can use that to learn various things. One thing you might hope to learn is the value of the mass of neutrinos. This is because the fact that neutrinos have mass tends to suppress the development of smaller scale structures and smaller scale clustering, because the neutrinos tend to free stream away from those potential wells, so they can't grow as much as they could if the neutrinos weren't there. And this gives you a suppression of this growth, particularly in the matter power spectrum on certain scales. So if you can make a map of these lensing deflections and trace that back to the statistics of these gravitational potentials as a function of scale, you can try and track where this scale suppression is happening and track that back into the precise value of the mass of neutrinos. More generally, these lensing maps give you a kind of integral constraint on the growth of structure, particularly at low redshifts, because again, you're doing this line of sight projection. So if you're interested in possible modifications of gravity or some more exotic physics driving what looks like dark energy to us, then you can try and constrain it just based on the amplitude and the shape of these lensing deflections that you get. Finally, if you have a map of lensing, you can hope to cross-correlate this map with other tracers of low redshift structure and try and tease out effects which might be obscured in the absence of these cross-correlations. So these would be things like the relationship between the clustering of galaxies and the underlying dark matter, or certain systematics in other types of lensing, such as galaxy shape lensing or CMB lensing. But cross-correlations, they generally tend to cancel out some of the noise that you get in each probe, and they also tend to break degeneracies between some different effects. So there's lots to learn about lensing in general, and there's lots you can learn from lensing. And one of the most successful arenas in which lensing has been detected is the CMB. So when we make maps of the cosmic microwave background radiation, we make maps of fluctuations in the temperature and polarization of this radiation in a certain range of wavelengths. And in the absence of lensing, the statistics of these fields are fairly simple. They can mostly be calculated with linear physics and linear transfer functions that you can calculate on your laptop with a few different public codes. And the statistics of these fields are mostly Gaussian, a very good approximation. On the other hand, if we have some gravitational potential that's sitting between us and a certain patch of the CMB, then it will tend to distort these fluctuations in a way which seems very intuitive. So it tends to magnify or demagnify and also shear some regions of these fluctuations, both in the temperature of the CMB or in the intensity and in the polarization E modes. And it also tends to convert some of these E modes into B modes on angular scales where they would generally be absent through very good approximation. So again, in this cartoon, this is a fairly severe example of lensing. Here, if you measure this map, you could just look here and say, aha, there's a lens there. But typically, again, we're not interested so much in these strong events. We're interested in, on average, the very weak effect of lensing on the statistics of these maps that we measure. And this effect has been detected for about 10 years now. The first detection was accomplished by Kendrick Smith and a few other collaborators at about 3.5 sigma in cross correlations between lensing and another low redshift tracer. And since that time, people have been working very hard to refine and develop the techniques that can be used to measure lensing of the CMB, which has led up to the current state of the art, which is a roughly 40 sigma total detection of lensing of the CMB temperature as measured by Planck, and slightly lower significance detections from some other ground-based experiments. So this plot was made by Alex van Engelen and is a compilation of the current state of the art of CMB lensing measurements. This black curve is predicted by the best fit cosmology to the Planck 2015 temperature anisotropies. Though this black curve is not fit to the points, it's just plotted on top. But we can see so far everything is very consistent. The curve is going right through these points within the uncertainties of the points. Modulo a slight discrepancy in the amplitude of this curve between other predictions of it. That isn't important for what I'm saying. But in general, the path looks promising. So far, this is a very clean picture, and people have been working very hard to make these measurements. Into the future, people are planning the next big thing in ground-based CMB detection, which is the CMB Stage 4 project, which is predicted to make a roughly 500 sigma detection of this lensing autospectrum. And once you get into numbers that are this high, it becomes a little silly to keep tracking things in terms of number of hundreds or thousands of sigmas. This is more suitable for the situation where you're trying to detect whether an effect happens or not. At this point, we definitely know that lensing happens. So what this 500 sigma really means is that we're beginning to get a very detailed characterization of the shape of this curve, and we can begin to pick out different physical effects which are having an impact on the shape, such as neutrino mass or other kind of growth. So at this point, the story is looking good. But there's been so much work put into these specific CMB lensing estimators and analysis techniques, we can ask whether there's any other kind of observations that we can apply all of this work to, whether we can just repurpose some of this work to gain even more information about the universe. And it seems like there might be a way forward with that in applying some of these techniques to the outcome of so-called line intensity mapping experiments. And the idea of line intensity mapping is the following. Is that typically, if you're making a survey, say a galaxy survey for cosmological purposes, typically you're looking in a certain range of wavelengths for some spectral features, and you're pointing your CCD or your telescope at the sky, but you can only detect objects down to a minimum flux or some kind of limiting magnitude. So if you have a certain way to pick out objects, in general, you'll only be able to pick out the brightest ones, for example, indicated by these red dots. Where there might be a ton of other objects that are emitting in these same wavelengths given by these gray points. And these you'll just completely miss if you're trying to pick out these points one by one and measure their position. And the idea of line intensity mapping is, instead of just trying to pick out the brightest ones, you just take all of the photons that you're measuring at a certain wavelength and then just bin them into rather coarse-grained pixels so that you can map out the large-scale structures that are being traced by these objects. Clearly, in this map, all of the fine-grained detail of the clustering here is lost. But in cosmology, there's a great amount of information which is just available in the large-scale modes. And this is exactly what's focused on here. And so in the instrumental design, you can make some trade-offs where maybe if you don't care about the smaller-scale modes, but you only want the large-scale modes, you can optimize yourself for just using a bigger pixel size and trying to collect all of that radiation. And this idea has been slowly catching on in the community. And recently there was a...
So the line and the line intensity, is this you do this for a specific line? Is that...
Yeah, so in generally that's the idea. Yeah, either with 21 centimeter or some other kind of emission or absorption line, you just pick the line and then you do that. So this people used to use the word intensity mapping for this more generally, but then other people were complaining that the CMB is also an intensity map. And there's a qualitative distinction there, where here, yeah, in this, we're actually talking about specific lines that are being emitted by objects. So that's where they're going.
So a question.
Yeah.
So I mean, the key thing for CMB is that you have to assume it's Gaussian to be able to do this. But here, I mean, what do you? I mean, of course, nonlinear structures are not Gaussian.
That's right. So you don't need to assume anything about these statistics to make the map. You can just make this map, and then in some cases, you might not actually care about cosmology. A lot of these things are going after this kind of mapping out star formation regions.
You haven't gotten into lensing yet. Okay.
So I haven't gotten into lensing yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you said low-angle resolution lensing in the future. I guess that's what I was asking. Sure.
Yeah. So this is in contrast to, say, high-angular resolution lensing, which would be like cosmic shear.
Mm-hmm.
But in thinking about low-angular resolution, these CMB lensing techniques are designed for this regime,
right.
And this is precisely the regime that these experiments are.
Is it also the Gaussianity thing that's
In a few slides, I'll come to this. Yeah. Okay, so there have been a series of roughly annual workshops organizing around this idea of line intensity mapping to kind of think of what can be done and to give the status of various experiments. And this was a big white paper that was submitted last year. And in this white paper, they made up this figure, which is not a completely comprehensive view of the field, but a mostly comprehensive view of all of the different experiments that are going to try to apply this technique to map out different parts of the universe in different lines. And so they're going to use a variety of different lines, either in hyperfine structure or rotational transitions or fine structure transitions in various things. And the details aren't so important, but what's most important is that there's a diverse array of effort going into this technique over a broad range of redshift, and also over a broad range of angular scales or pixel size on the sky. And so once each of these experiments has made its map, you could take a given map and ask whether you could try and measure its lensing using techniques similar to CMB lensing. At least that's one way to think about it. And so I think there's a lot of motivation to go after this direction. One reason is that, as I said, the CMB is basically a single two-dimensional screen that you're looking at the statistics of and trying to figure out what the lensing signal is in there. In the line intensity mapping case, since you're measuring a line, if you measure that line at a slightly different frequency, you know that that shift is mostly due to a redshift. You can map the redshift into a radial distance. So now you can build up a whole 3D picture of structure. Or one way to say it is, now you have a bunch of very finely spaced 2D screens with transverse fluctuations on each one. And you can think of applying a lensing reconstruction procedure to each screen. Now, if the screens are closely spaced enough, then they're basically going to be lensed by the same structure with the same line of sight projection. You can think of doing a lensing reconstruction on each one and then combining all of these estimates in order to beat down the total noise you get on your reconstruction of the potential. If, on the other hand, you have sets of screens that are more widely spaced, then they'll be lensing somewhat different structures. And so you get these different line of sight projection kernels. And if you can measure the lensing of each set of screens, then you can start to do tomography and build up actually a growth history of what the fluctuations are doing. Again, directly tracing the fluctuations without having to go through galaxies or some other bias tracers. These kind of reconstructions will have different systematics in general than CMB or galaxy lensing. Probably some of the systematics will actually be shared with the CMB, but many of them will be quite orthogonal to galaxy lensing. So this is really a distinct way to probe the fluctuations in the low redshift universe for various purposes. And finally, if we look into the future, if we think of doing a very large area intensity mapping survey and looking at the higher order statistics, searching for things like primordial non-Gaussianity, the effect of lensing will also generate these higher order statistics, and this will be a contaminant that we need to understand if we can try and dig out smaller signals. This is already well known, for example, in Planck, where the cross-correlation between CMB lensing and the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect gives you an FNL local of roughly order one, which is something you need to subtract from these measurements in order to actually put constraints on non-Gaussianity. But in the future, if you think of trying to do this with a higher redshift intensity mapping survey, then you'll definitely need to understand this as well.
Actually,
yeah.
Quick question. So is the idea to use high redshift intensity maps to learn about
low redshift lenses? Or is the idea that you're getting something beyond the measurement of structure you get from the intensity maps themselves, from lenses that are in the redshift range of the intensity maps?
I would say it's mostly the first part. You're mostly looking at structures that are completely a lower redshift.
Okay.
You can also use similar techniques to learn about modes which are at the same redshift as the intensity map, which I'll touch on a bit later. But mostly the idea is the same as the classic lensing thing. Just learn about lenses in between you and the thing you're observing. So that's the setup for what I'm going to talk about. From here, I'm going to give you a lightning review of how lensing is reconstructed from the CMB, from its effect on the statistics of the maps. And that will just be for a 2D screen, but I'll show you how to generalize that procedure from 2D into estimators and into estimates in three dimensions. And also argue, as has already been preempted, that the impact of non-linearities or non-Gaussianities in the map is going to have a significant impact on what you would infer about the lensing of the map. And then I'll argue that this effect can also be at least partially reduced by borrowing a technique also from CMB lensing known as bias hardening. So I'll go through how that technique works. And I'll close out with some forecasts about current and upcoming intensity mapping surveys, and with what significance we might be able to measure lensing in each of these surveys. So just in the first part, here is a rather terse review of CMB lensing. So let me just try and walk you through all these steps. So we start with phi, which is called the lensing potential, which is this line of sight projection I mentioned over the gravitational potentials at lower redshift, where we're integrating from our position at a moving distance zero up to some source distance. For the CMB, the source distance is at redshift 1100. For an intensity map, it might be, you know, it will be somewhere within the range that we're observing. It'll be on one of these screens. Now, if we look at the observed temperature T as a function of this theta vector, where this is a 2D vector telling you your transverse position on a flat patch of sky, the lensed map is related to the unlensed map T tilde by a simple remapping of coordinates, where this deflection field is telling you how much the coordinates are shifting based on the total effect of all the lenses along the line of sight. And in the Born approximation and other approximations, which are generally good in this case, you can write this deflection field as just the gradient of this lensing potential. If these deflections are small, then you can tailor expand this remapping around the unlensed map, and the difference between the lensed and unlensed maps is going to be the gradient of phi times the gradient of the underlying unlensed map. If we now move to Fourier space and we do a 2D Fourier transform into this Fourier vector L, then the difference in the Fourier modes between the lensed and the unlensed map is going to be equal to this convolution over the Fourier modes of the phi map and the Fourier modes of the unlensed temperature. Now, if we take this and we do a two-point correlation of these Fourier modes, where this little L and big L minus little L are different in general, if we take an ensemble average over realizations of the lensed map, where the distribution of lenses is held fixed, then at leading order, we just get this diagonal correlation, this power spectrum of the unlensed map, which would be there just in the absence of lensing. But lensing adds a new piece. Lensing also, in fact, correlates distinct Fourier modes of this map with this mode coupling function, which you can derive, but I haven't written down. And it correlates them in a way which is proportional to this Fourier mode of the lensing map. So one way to think of this is that ordinarily the statistics of the CMB are homogeneous and isotropic. So if you shift the whole CMB and then compute its statistics, it should still have the same ones. But now if we have a fixed distribution of lenses in front of you, if you shift the CMB, you can detect that you shifted it because you can tell where it was in relation to the lenses. That's roughly the idea. So this breaks the translation invariance of the statistics of the CMB map, and this breaking of the statistics. This breaking of translation invariance means that you can get away from this purely diagonal term, and so the different modes of the map become coupled this way.
In your first equation, what is this chi? Some sort of radial distance?
Oh, sorry, I should have said. Yeah, the chi is the radial distance from the observer to the source. Right.
That's chi-S. Chi is the integrated power, right?
Oh, sorry, you're right. This is really bad. I didn't put a measure in this integral. You're integrating over chi, so the co-moving distance between you and the source. You're integrating over all these potentials at each distance away from
you. I thought you just don't like measures of integrals. You don't have them.
I do like them. So here, whenever there's a Fourier integral, I use this shorthand because there's some two pi's and I don't like to write those. This one, it's a no measure. Yeah. Good, thanks. Okay, so if we have this off-diagonal mode coupling, we can use this to make a simplistic estimator of the Fourier modes of its lensing potential. We can take a pair of Fourier modes separated by big L. We can divide them by this mode coupling function. And this should be roughly equal to this. Now, of course, this temperature map is going to have noise on it. So this is going to be a noisy estimate of phi. But in the ensemble average sense, this thing is going to have mean equal to this. So it's still a reasonable estimator we can write down. Maybe a little noisy. But you can actually do better than this. And this was shown most famously by Wayne Hu in a series of papers a little time ago. You can take this naive estimator, which is only for a given little L, and then you can improve it by integrating over all pairs of Fourier modes of the lensed map separated by this big L, times some weight, which you can derive based on calculating the variance of this thing and then weighting these pairs with the inverse of that variance. And then you can add in some normalization of this estimator such that this estimator is unbiased again. So now this phi hat has the minimal possible variance of any quadratic estimator under the assumption that this temperature field is Gaussian. And this is the estimator that is typically used in actual analyses of the CMB. Or some, you know, this is the idea. So now we can do this big L by big L, build up an estimate of each Fourier mode of this phi map, and then inverse Fourier transform that to get actually a real space picture of this phi, which will again be related to line of sight projections of the lenses. Now, if we take this reconstructed map and compute its power spectrum, the contributions we'll get will be equal to the power spectrum, just the underlying theoretical power spectrum of phi, which is the signal that we would like, and also this NL. So by construction, this NL is equal to the way that we've normalized the estimator. This NL also acts as an additive bias on our estimate of CL phi phi that we'll need to compute and subtract in order to extract this. And this NL will also affect the error bars on this CL phi phi. So it acts as both a bias and a noise on this power spectrum. And the source of this NL is just the disconnected four-point function of the map. So since this phi hat is quadratic in T, this power spectrum of phi hat is actually the four-point function of this temperature map. And this has a disconnected contribution, which isn't coming from lensing, it's just coming from Gaussian statistics. And then if you turn on lensing, you turn on a connected four-point contribution, which gives you this lensing potential power spectrum. And that's it. That's the necessary background. So does anyone have any questions about that before I go on?
It was crystal clear.
Crystal clear. Yeah. That's not a question, though. Okay, so we're going to extend this. Sorry, yeah.
In devising this estimator that Wayne Hu did, I guess, you assumed Gaussian behavior, but then you're making corrections. Does that affect the estimator, or just affect its optimality, or something?
It will affect both, yeah. So in general, these corrections, they will enter as part of these dots. For the CMB, they're generally small, but they're still large enough that you need to write them down and model them. And it will also affect the optimality of the estimator. So this inverse variance weight is based on Gaussian statistics. If now there's more complicated mode couplings, then you can make things more optimal by modifying these weights. But then computing this whole estimator becomes more computationally intensive. So there's a trade-off that you need to make. Okay. So this was just the 2D case. If we want to extend this to three dimensions, like we have in an intensity map, it proceeds in a fairly natural way. So now we can think of an observed 3D intensity field as a function both of the transverse coordinate and the line of sight coordinate, which I called chi earlier, but now it's x parallel, just for symmetry in the notation. And we can Fourier transform this intensity in all directions. In the transverse direction, and in the radial direction into Fourier mode scale parallel. Now, if we're observing within some co-moving thickness, some co-moving line of sight thickness L, then these line of sight Fourier modes will be discrete, and we can index them with this integer J. Typically, we're also measuring on a finite patch in the transverse direction, so this L will also be discrete, but that's not so important for the argument I'm making. So now we've taken this previous picture we had of different slices, different 2D slices at different redshift, and we've gone to Fourier space and kind of mixed up the representation so that now each of these J's will represent 3D Fourier modes of the intensity with a different parallel component given by this K parallel. So each of these J maps now has these different parallel Fourier components in it. If we take the 2D power spectrum of each of these slices, it's related to the 3D power spectrum of the intensity, evaluated on the norm of the 3D vector corresponding to the transverse wave vector that we have, and also the radial wave vector that we have. And so now with each of these J maps, we can take each one and try and just apply the same estimator that we used before. And now we're trying to estimate a mode of phi with transverse wave number L from modes of the intensity with radial wave number K parallel. And this looks very similar to what we saw before. We're integrating over pairs of Fourier modes of the intensity, now at the same K parallel, but at different transverse wave numbers. We're giving them this inverse variance weighting, and we're multiplying by normalization to keep this thing unbiased. If we now take a reconstructed phi map from a given value of this K parallel and take its power spectrum, we again find CL phi phi, plus we find this Gaussian noise term that I mentioned before. Now, since we have reconstructions from all these different J's or all these different K parallels, we can try and add them up to reduce the noise. And when we do that, what we'll find generally is that the variance on our reconstruction of a given mode of this phi map is going to go like this, this inverse sum here, which if all these noises are the same for each J, it'll go down roughly like 1 over the number of J's, because this Gaussian noise component is uncorrelated between our different reconstructions from the different J's. And this argument is true if the statistics of the intensity is Gaussian. If there's a deviation from that assumption, then actually this argument misses an important fact. So if we go back again and look at our power spectrum of the reconstructed phi map, and since phi is quadratic in I, this power spectrum is actually some kind of filtered four-point function of the observed intensity field. If we break this down and see what's inside, there's the disconnected four-point function, which I mentioned already. There's a contribution to the connected four-point function here from lensing. And this is just CL phi phi because we've normalized the estimator by construction to make the coefficient here unity. And if this intensity has any other connected four-point function, where I tilde is the unlensed intensity, so if there's some connected four-point which has nothing to do with lensing, then in this power spectrum of the phi map, you're also going to get a contribution, which is a filtered version of this term. And this could possibly compete with the lensing effect that you're trying to infer. Furthermore, if this intensity field is a tracer of delta matter, which it must be in some way, because that's one of the points of the line intensity mapping technique, then this connected four-point is going to have a contribution from the trispectrum just induced by gravitational evolution of the density field. And so you can ask what other contributions might be in here as well. But this one is actually, you know, if this one is too big, then I think the entire idea falls on its face. Or at least you need to worry about it more carefully. So the agenda that we did in our, that we followed in our paper was just to try and estimate how big this contribution is compared to the lensing signal for various cases of interest. The way we did this was to restrict ourselves to a fairly straightforward theoretical setting within which we can control all the aspects of the calculation that, that we're concerned with. So what we're going to do is suppose that the unlensed intensity field is a linearly biased tracer of delta matter. We're going to use tree-level perturbation theory for the connected four-point function of delta matter. So if you know the lingo, this tri-spectrum of delta matter is order delta linear to the sixth. That's the lowest non-trivial contribution. It has an f2 squared term and an f3 to the 1 term times some functions of the linear power spectrum that I haven't written down, times some factors of that spectrum. And in cases where we need to worry about foregrounds in the intensity mapping signal, we're going to accomplish that by setting a hard k-parallel cut. We're going to throw away modes with k-parallel below some cut. This is motivated by the fact that in 21 centimeter at least, there are lots of foregrounds which are much bigger than the signal, but these foregrounds are typically fairly smooth in frequency, which means that they're living in the regime in Fourier space of very low k-parallel. So if we assume that the foregrounds are destroying modes of a certain length, and that we can use modes above that length, then we can use that as a rough way to deal with this. And of course, we can vary this cut if we're more or less optimistic about how you can deal with those foregrounds.
What do you mean by tree-level perturbations? What would be loops? What is going on?
Good. So that's a whole talk in itself.
Okay.
But it's essentially, if you're looking at the matter distribution at large scales, the fluctuations are very small, so you can linearize all the equations of motion for this delta matter. And so in that case, you only have Gaussian statistics because you assume that the linear initial field is Gaussian. Now, if you want to incorporate deviations from that nonlinearity, you can introduce these small corrections back into the equations of motion and solve for them order by order. And what these corrections will do is that they'll generate connected higher point functions, which are not just products of the two-point function. And when you write down that perturbation theory, you can say the matter field is roughly the linear matter field plus the second order piece plus the third order piece. And you can start to write these down as tree diagrams where you have a line and then it's bifurcating at higher and higher orders. And now with the correlation functions, you can similarly write those down by taking these tree diagrams and sewing together some of the legs. And so the lowest order that you can get will be tree level, because the diagrams that you get, they won't have any closed loops. But for example, in the power spectrum, the leading correction is one. There's one that looks like a diagram like this, where now there's a closed loop. So it's a complete analogy with Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory.
It's just the classical equations of motion.
It's the classical equations of motion with initial conditions that are a classical stochastic field. Yeah, and so it's these fluctuations which give you this kind of.
So I guess it's reminds me, if it involves integrals over k, then it's loops, right? That's what this. So
basically, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so any other questions about these assumptions that I've made?
Why did you neglect the loop? You said the leading correction was.
Sorry, yeah.
For 4-point function, there's a tree level. For 2-point function, it's
isolated.
That's right. Yeah, so the 4-point function, the connected 4-point function, it vanishes if you're just considering the leading order. And then at the next leading order, the first non-trivial diagram that you get in this 4-point function has no loops. And then the loops will all be suppressed by factors related to the smallness of the perturbations. So in this regime, you need to make sure that the perturbations you're dealing with are small. And we did a numerical calculation to try and estimate where this assumption is good and where it breaks, and then we limited ourselves to those scales.
So maybe it's taking you too far afield, but if you write down what looks like a Feynman diagram, what are the interpretations of the vertices and the legs and so on?
I think the interpretations of the legs, I would say, are just you're taking two Fourier modes of the density field, and you're saying what's the correlation between those modes in the ensemble average. So in the linear theory, you just have two modes, and those modes are only correlated if they have equal and opposite wave number. And then as you go to higher and higher order corrections, they will generate a whole ladder of correlations based on the linear modes interacting with other copies of the linear modes. And then all of those interactions affecting the correlations when you try and correlate them together.
And the vertex means what then?
The vertex is it's a way to visualize those correlations. So in kind of the particle physics sense, you have plane waves that don't interact, but then there are plane waves which can interact with other particle states. And those states can then interact with each other. It's the same idea here, except in this case, it's just Fourier modes of the density field. And the interactions are caused by the nonlinear effect of gravity.
I think it's nonlinear effect of gravity. It could be just nonlinear effect of matter, not just gravity. Because So I don't think that's a little bit of a stronger statement, I think. So I'm just thinking, if you just have, even if gravity has, there's no gravity, you just have initial conditions and particles move on random trajectories, then at some point densities become nonlinear, form caustics and things like that. So,
but if there's no gravity, they won't interact, right?
But the density field does become nonlinear and develops all endpoint functions, right?
Even in the absence of gravity?
Yeah, in Eulerian coordinates, it does, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Just because of the motion.
Right? Oh, right, sorry, yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, I agree with that.
Is there some Lagrangian you write down that generates all of these?
It hasn't been done as often. You can explore kind of Lagrangian ways to write this down. What's more commonly seen is that you just work directly with the equations of motion. And then you basically, at the linear level, you can solve those equations just fine. And then to incorporate the nonlinear effects, you calculate the Green's function corresponding to the linear equations of motion. And you convolve that Green's function against the nonlinear corrections, which are acting as a source. And then you do this iteratively, order by order, and so you can build up an iterative solution, which is different from the way things are done kind of in the quantum sense, in which you start with the action and then work it down. In this case, you can also start with the equations of motion, and it's a little easier to handle.
I think there is a version of, and it doesn't, in quantum theory, there is a version of that's more analogous, where you use the retarded Green's function.
Yeah, it's definitely, yeah.
I'm not sure where it comes from.
You're talking about Schringer-Kallisch?
No, not Schringer-Kallisch. Well, that, of course.
Schringer is sort of pretty fine in the diagram.
I don't know. I think I saw some Russians. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe Schringer did it as well.
Move on.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So if there are no other questions, this is somewhat important to the talk, but it's good that we got a chance to explore what this actually means beyond just writing down a few of these functions. Okay. So with this setup in place, the first thing that we can look at in the intensity mapping context is the two-dimensional power spectrum of these kind of mixed Fourier representations of the slices of the intensity at different values of J or different values of K parallel. So this is just kind of an illustration. In particular, this is for a certain survey that they expect to do with SKA around redshift 8. But this is more just an illustration to see the general trend I'd like to point out, which is as you go higher and higher in J, you're moving to smaller line of sight modes. You can see that the amplitude of this power spectrum is gradually decreasing and decreasing. And at some point, it drops below the instrumental noise that you'll get, just the fluctuations in the receivers and the interferometers. And at that point, modes with high enough J become noise dominated. So the instrumental noise is setting a maximum J that you can use for the lensing reconstruction. And recall that the minimum J we set based on the fact that foregrounds will probably kill these modes. So you have some limited range of J that you're working within. If we move now to predictions or contributions to the power spectrum of this reconstructed lensing map phi hat, again, at a given value of K parallel, I've put here, we can begin to look at these contributions in a simple example. So this black curve is CL phi phi. This is the signal we would like to obtain from this power spectrum of the reconstructed map. The green curve is the Gaussian noise that I spoke about earlier. And this blue curve is the influence of this gravitational trispectrum on the power spectrum of this lensing map. So recall that these n terms, they have a few different effects. They give you an additive bias on CL phi phi. So clearly, if you measure this reconstructed power spectrum, you're going to measure the sum of all these. And you'll need to subtract these guys in order to recover the signal. So you'll need to model them somehow, or measure them in some other way. And these curves will also affect the noise on our reconstructed CL phi phi. So if I was also to plot some toy error bars along this black curve, these error bars would have contributions from both of these. So at least in this case, we find a somewhat disappointing result. In this case, we found that these gravitational contributions are completely swamping the contributions from lensing over the entire range of scales that I've plotted. And this can
So are you going to tell us whether, I mean, K parallel dependence? Well, actually, even just K or L dependence could be used to separate these up.
So I'll come to how to separate these a bit in a moment. Basically, yeah, you can dig into the guts of this estimator and you can try and pull out the mode couplings. But I'll talk about that in detail a bit later. So just one thing to illustrate is if you at least change the J that you're using for the reconstruction, then what we find is that this gravitational contribution is roughly staying at more or less the same place. This depends on the instrument you're looking at, but in general, the amplitude of this is relatively stable. The amplitude of this green curve is moving up as you go to increasing J. Because, as I said before, for higher J, the modes you're using for the lensing reconstruction are more and more noisy. And so this is basically the noise per mode in the lensing reconstruction. And so eventually, this curve just blows up because you're trying to use just noisy modes from your measurement. And so again, this is roughly the J max where that happens. Beyond this, this curve just shoots right up.
Last one. J was the number of the screen, is that?
So J was an index to the parallel component of the Fourier mode, of the 3D intensity. So we did this 3D Fourier transform. Yeah. And so we can split it up into a line of sight K parallel mode. But since we're only observing within some finite width, we're actually doing a discrete Fourier transform. So the Fourier modes along that direction are going to be quantized into these J's.
So you're not literally looking at a discrete set of screens, is that right? It's just a sort of way of thinking. Conceiving what's going on?
It's, I guess there are two things. One is that in reality, the screens always will be discrete just because you have a finite frequency resolution in the thing you're measuring. So that's one point. The second point, I guess, is that if you're looking in this finite range and you're doing a Fourier transform, figuring out all the Fourier modes that can fit within that range, they will be discrete just because of the boundary conditions of the Fourier transform.
Right, but that's just in the analysis of the data. It's not in gathering.
It can be in gathering the data as well, because if you think of the way the electronics work, when you take some continuous signal and you try and split it up into different frequencies, there's always going to be some fundamental frequency resolution of which you're resolving things. And so that resolution can also limit the maximum J, but typically this is a stronger limitation, this kind of this noise limitation.
In that sense, even transverse things are split up.
That's right. Yeah, so the transverse things will be split up based on various kind of resolution related things. So when you actually analyze the data, everything is going to be discrete and your estimators will have to modify it. So this is what happens at a single J, just roughly how things are scaling. If we now try and take these lensing reconstructions and combine them from different J maps, what we find is that if we only assume that the Gaussian noise is present, these contributions are dropping as you include more and more of these J's. And eventually they don't drop anymore because the noise is blowing up here. So adding in another noisy measurement isn't going to help you that much. If we now turn on the gravitational effects, what we find is that your gain from using more and more of these J's is not as much as it was in the absence of gravitational noise, or in this gravitational contribution. One of the reasons for this, beyond the fact that this curve is just present sitting on top of this one, is that, as I mentioned before, this Gaussian noise is uncorrelated between the different J's. So if you're averaging over different J's, these are effectively independent noise realizations that you can just average away. This gravitational term, since it's coming from correlations in 3D, it's also correlating the modes between different J's. So as you add up more of these reconstructions and you calculate the combined noise, this contribution is dropping. This contribution is not dropping because it's correlated between all these screens. And so at some point, the combined contribution of this is dropping below the contribution of this. And we can see this here, where up here it's dominated by the Gaussian noise, but here it's gradually taking on the shape of this gravitational term, telling you that that becomes the dominant contribution in the limit of the high number of J's. So this is certainly something that you'll need to deal with if you're thinking about trying to do this analysis. So this is the setup in the 3D case. Just to summarize, you can apply this 2D CMB lensing estimator to the 3D setup by just Fourier transforming your map along the line of sight as well, and then applying the map to modes, applying the estimator to modes of the map with different k-parallel values. And we find that gravity adds a bias and a noise to the lensing reconstruction that's correlated between the k-parallels. So if you add more of them, you can't beat it down in the same way that you could with the Gaussian contribution. Now, there is a way to try and mitigate some of this effect, and it's similar to things that are done in CMB lensing. So to drive, or to see how you might do this, we can go back and dig into some of these perturbative expressions. So again, in the perturbative sense, if we think of the Fourier modes of the lensed intensity at leading order in everything, if we ignore the linear bias, which isn't important, at leading order, there's just the linear matter density sitting here. The leading non-trivial order is in lensing. As we saw before, it's a convolution between the Fourier modes of phi and the modes of delta 1. What gravity is doing, as we discussed a bit earlier, is it's coupling together different modes of delta linear with this mode coupling kernel, which you can derive from the equations of motion. So these are the main effects to consider at second order in the fluctuating field. In order to work with this a bit more efficiently, we can take this expression and collapse it down schematically. So now I has contributions like delta linear, like order delta phi, and order delta delta. Now in this reconstructed power spectrum, again, we're looking at the four-point function of I, and we can again break this down to see what's inside. In the absence of lensing, or at lowest order, when I is just delta linear, we get this disconnected contribution. If we consider leading order and lensing, where there are two delta linears and two order delta phi terms, delta linear and phi are both Gaussian and uncorrelated with each other. So in order to figure this one out, we just do the Witt contractions. So if we take one phi from each copy of phi hat and correlate it, and we take the two remaining deltas, which are inside each phi hat, and correlate them together, then we get the C alpha phi we want, which a coefficient with a coefficient which has been normalized to unity by construction. If we now take the term of the same order and correlate these deltas between the two estimators, then we don't get a particular proportionality here. Instead, we get something which is convolving various factors of these low order spectra together. We can call this a connected lensing bias, which is also present in the CMB case. But in that case, and in our case as well, this term is fairly subdominant, so we can just ignore it for our purposes. And we can repeat the same exercise at leading order and gravitational nonlinearities. So now if there's a delta linear and a delta delta, if we do this pattern of contractions, where two of them are contracted in between the estimators, we now find something which is directly proportional to the power spectrum of delta, of modes of delta which are being correlated together by gravity, times some prefactor which is not unity. It'll be something else that you can calculate. If we do the same pattern of contractions here, just contract everything together across this bridge, we now find this connected gravitational term, which is again just convolutions over factors of the power spectra and some kernels. And this is a comprehensive list of these contributions that we get. And if we look at these terms, we can see that some of them look the same. In particular, this term is proportional to the power spectrum of long modes of phi, which are being coupled by lensing. This one is the power spectrum of long modes of the density, which are being coupled to other modes of the density by gravity. And the way we started was by designing an estimator for the modes of phi and then taking its power spectrum. And we found this, which is unfortunately biased by this. But just looking at this analogy, you can also think of running the process from the other motivation, trying to design an estimator for these long wavelength modes of delta, trying to get this in an unbiased way, but unfortunately finding that it's contaminated by this. And so now we have two things which are both biased by the other thing. So we can write this down more formally, where we can write down two different quadratic estimators where these filters G are different, and we're trying to estimate either the modes of phi or the modes of delta. If we take their expectation value, each one is biased by the other thing, but now we just have a linear system of two equations. So we can just solve on the right-hand side for either phi or delta, and use that to define new estimators, so-called bias-hardened estimators, which are free of the bias from the other guy at leading order. In CMB lensing, this is used, such as in this paper, and also by Planck, to get rid of various mode couplings coming from the mask or from residual point sources in the maps and various other things like that. But in this case, at least in the setup here, we're really doing something fairly clean. We're just saying there's phi, there's delta, and we want to split them up, and we can recombine these estimators this way. One downside is that these bias-hardened estimators will have increased variance corresponding to the old estimators by a factor which depends on how much these estimators were originally correlated. So if the action of lensing and the action of gravitational evolution was basically the same thing, then these estimators would already look fairly similar, and we wouldn't be able to subtract them. So their difference would be very noisy. And this would imply that this rho is close to 1, so then this thing blows up. If, on the other hand, these mode couplings are fairly distinct, then we can actually separate them cleanly, and we don't take very much hit in the noise that we have after that. So if we go back now and think about our previous picture, so here's a reconstructed map power spectrum with the signal we want, gravity, and the Gaussian part. By digging a bit deeper, we can now separate this blue curve into two curves. The curve which is directly proportional to this long modes, and the curve which is some other convolution over these modes, which generally kind of washes out the angular structure and turns it into white noise, its representation. If we now make the same plot for a map constructed with the bias-hardened estimator, by construction, this blue curve has completely vanished. We've stripped off the part which is disproportional to delta. This curve is staying roughly where it is, which is fairly generic, although it can get a bit of a boost. This Gaussian, This Gaussian part gets a bit of a boost based on the correlation between the original estimators. In this diagram, it's not so bad. In other cases, it can be more severe. So it's something to be aware of. But in general, if you have a choice between a biased or a noisy observation, you want to take the noisy one every time, because a bias won't decrease as you make more measurements. So a bias will, if you can't understand that, then you're screwed, right? You have some unknown signal. Whereas with a noise, you can eventually just try and spend a bit more time or a bit more money and beat down the noise and still make sure you're learning robust things. And so that's the motivation for this bias art feature. So in the process of developing this bias-hardened lensing estimator, we also wrote down an estimator for long modes of delta. And so we can actually think about cases in which we might want to just forget about lensing and try and reconstruct these long modes of delta instead. So there are other estimators that have been written down in the literature, mainly based on the action of tidal fields and how they're coupling to delta. So this is it's become known as tidal reconstruction, and we use that name here. So Whaley Penn at CETA and his group have written several papers with an estimator which differs in the details, but it has the same idea. And I am also starting to work with some new collaborators on trying to flesh out how this works in the presence of nonlinear bias. So in an intensity map at smaller scales, or even in a redshift survey, can you use these small scale statistics to try and reconstruct long wavelength modes of delta? And this is something which there are some extra subtleties here, but we're getting to work on that. And so in an example where you're observing at low-ish redshift, where low redshift here is redshift 2, over a slab of thickness delta z equals 0.5, you find that the noise you get from lensing, at least for these angular resolutions, is not looking so great. But if you turn things around and try and use the gravitational effects, which are much stronger at these redshifts, then in fact it's possible that you can get some signal-dominated maps just of pure delta on its own. And you just get that kind of for free, in a sense, from the formalism we've just written down. Obviously, the implementation is more complicated, so that's why we're still working on it. But the idea is there. So just as a summary of that part, we can mitigate some of these gravitational effects by using the bias hardening procedure, basically by modifying the lensing estimator to try and subtract off the dominant bias, which we can compute. This will increase the noise on the estimator in a way which depends on the observational setup. So in the last part, I have some forecasts. I think I only have a few minutes left of the scheduled time. So maybe I'll just try and run through these super quickly, and then in the questions, if anyone wants more details. Okay, so here are some 21 centimeter interferometers. SKA is not a dedicated instrument, but it's going to plan some intensity mapping as part of its aims. Chime is the hometown hero. Hopefully people know about Chime. It's in Penticton, BC, where my family used to go for summer vacations. Can't go there anymore. Well, actually, it's in a radio-protected site, so we can never go there. So Chime, yep, Chime is in BC. Hyrax is in South Africa, with basically the same goals and the same redshift range as Chime. But for this purpose, you can basically think of Hyrax as a version of Chime with twice the angular resolution. What we find, again, moving very quickly, is that if we take some nominal properties for these instruments, our precision on measurements of the lensing auto spectra is generally going to be quite poor, partly because gravitational effects are obscuring it, and partly because you need to apply bias hardening in order to do this measurement. And at these redshifts and at these angular resolutions, bias hardening is actually strongly boosting the noise. So the signal to noise is very low here.
How do I know the signal to noise is low? What number should I expect? So is this 3.7, is that the noise, or is that?
So this 3.7, it's the total signal to noise on a measurement of the lensing auto spectrum across any.
Okay, so that's
any,
signal to noise.
Yeah, okay. So on the auto spectrum, it's not looking so great. If you think of a large photometric survey like LSST, and consider cross correlations of this lensing with either the galaxy clustering or the galaxy lensing, things are starting to look more hopeful, partly because the precision on these quantities is going to be very high with LSST, and partly because you can arrange these cross correlations such that you do not need to bias harden. Extra bias in the lensing maps will not cross correlate with the lower redshift tracers. So these numbers, I think are looking fairly hopeful. You don't even need LSST for this. In general, you can have a survey with large area, but with much lower number density and still get numbers comparable to this. You're really limited by the precision you can get on lensing. But in any way, at least these numbers are slightly optimistic based on the modeling assumptions, but at least it means that it might be worth some further study about trying to do this analysis.
If you didn't do this bias harding, you just ignore the nonlinearities, then what would you have gotten?
I think you'll get a factor of a few better for these numbers.
A few being,
you know, like 2, 3, 4. It kind of depends. Basically, the thing is, if you think of like Chime has L max of kind of 1,000 or a bit less. But for this lensing reconstruction, you really want small scales because you want lots of pairs of modes that you can correlate. And these experiments weren't designed for this, so in general, they fall just a bit short of what you would want. I think I'm not going to talk about this at all. We can come back to that later. So CCAT is a telescope they're building in Chile on this mountain, which is even higher than ALMA is. So it's very high. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so one of the things that CCAT will do is an intensity mapping survey of ionized carbon to measure this fine structure transition. The modeling is very uncertain, so it's not possible to make these kind of clean-ish signal-to-noise numbers. Instead, what we do is we try and plot the signal-to-noise on each of these cross correlations as a function of the J-max. Because with a higher precision measurement of the C2 fluctuations, you'll get a higher number of J's that you can use. And in this case, if you look at the 6-meter dish, which is what CCAT actually is, you find that in some of these redshift slices, you might get appreciable signal-to-noise. If you add up all of these significances, you'll get something in the order tens range, probably the high tens if you add up all of these adjacent redshift bands that you have. So in this case, it's still looking possible. You lose based on the fact that it's a very fairly small area of sky. You win based on the fact that the angular resolution is very high. And finally, you can think about the next generation of 21-centimeter surveys after Chime and Hyrax have finished. And there's a group led by Ange Slosar, which I'm involved in, which has been looking at this question, and we'll publish a white paper on this soon. Basically thinking about what might you want to do for the next generation. If stage one is like this, what might you want to do? So we can just pick some straw person configuration and try and do forecasts and see what it would do. The straw person configuration we've chosen is this one, 64 times the number of dishes in Hyrax, observing from redshift 2 to 6, which is generally kind of a redshift desert. It's a range that's tough to access with other probes. If you do this, you can try and learn much more about cosmology. essentially based on the fact that you're measuring much more volume and much more linear modes than lower redshift surveys. You're gaining roughly a factor of 3 in volume from redshift 2 to 6 compared to 0 to 2. If we move on to lensing and we compare lensing forecasts for this experiment, either with complete foreground removal or with somewhat more pessimistic assumptions, and compare them to what you get from CMBS4, you find that at least in cross-correlation, the numbers are roughly competitive. So this might be an interesting science case for this experiment. Also, you can do tidal reconstruction very well. This experiment won't be cheap, but neither will CMBS4. So from that perspective, it's at least encouraging that you can get competitive precision on different lensing, right? This isn't just repeating CMBS4 lensing. This is doing lensing at much lower redshifts. So again, this is signal-to-noise on a full tomographic measurement of potentials at even lower redshifts. And there's also a workshop about this, which is going to be happening in Brookhaven later this summer. And there's still plenty of spots open for registration, is what I hear. So if anyone's interested, I think it'll be a lot of fun and be very interesting. So that's all that I had to say. So just in summary, first detections of intensity mapping lensing may be possible in the near term. I think it's worth looking at more. And if we dream big and we think about a stage 2 21 centimeter survey, it could even do some things which are competitive with CMBS4, and it will also up some new science that's hard to do with either the CMB or with galaxy surveys. And that's all.
Questions, so we're gonna have dinner with Simon at 6 in the bistro. So, question? Yes,
Basil. So, does 21 high Z experiment low for MWA, those ones are now obsolete for this kind of thing? Or?
No, they're not obsolete. I didn't focus on them much. Mainly because for our forecast, we just wanted to do kind of a representative sample. So this SKA survey is partly overlapping with those. Also in those, the modeling of the intensity field is more difficult because reionization is happening. So you'll have kind of patches of ionization, which will probably give you fairly strong non-Gaussian contributions as well, which is going to be an extra step in the modeling. So those experiments, I wouldn't say they're obsolete, but there's more effort from the theory side that needs to be done before you can do this.
So 64 Hyraxes primarily give you more sensitivity, or is it a baseline thing that you're getting more resolution, or?
It's basically a combination, although I think at least for lensing, it's just more resolution. Yeah, it's the fact that you can resolve a much smaller scale.
Longer baseline, I suppose.
Yeah.
Linguistic question, but why did you say bias hardening? It sounds like it ought to be called bias removal or something.
I really don't know. It seems like it's an interesting choice of words, but no one has been able to give me a good answer.
Track that vocabulary.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have 2 questions. One is, sorry, is someone else? Another source of my bias is just shot noise in the maps. Have you looked into that? You're squaring the map. You say that's you square up the real density thing. You say, but the shot noise is also important.
Yeah, in 21 centimeter, people have been making more refined models of the shot noise, and generally, it's subdominant on the scales that we're working on. So that's okay for various intensity mapping things, particularly for CCAT. There might be a large regime you're looking at where actually your shot noise dominated. From the astrophysics perspective, you can learn certain things.
You're talking about just the power spectrum is not shot noise dominated, or the connected tri-spectrum is what you care about. And you say that's not also dominated by shot noise, dominated by the gravitation.
For 21 centimeter, you can use these models and you can test. Excuse me, that the shot noise trispectrum is subdominant. For CCAT, it's not clear. That's not necessarily a showstopper because at least if you're in the Poisson regime in the power spectrum, then you just have a flat spectrum. So shearing doesn't do anything else, but convergence moves it up and down, which means that you can actually use not so much the WHO estimator, but also a specific estimator which just tracks the convergence. And that there might be some efficiencies in doing that actually in the Poisson regime. But as far as noise, that's something that will need to be figured out that we haven't done yet.
So another, just one last comment. Actually, is there any other questions? So one thing I think is interesting is, I mean, when we do lensing on a small scale, it's like with optical servers, you don't do this stuff. You look at galaxy shapes. So have you thought about doing something like that? Maybe interpolating these two regimes.
Well, the thing is, part of the main regime of intensity maps is that you're working on large angular scales. So you in galaxy lensing, you benefit by the fact that you can look at a blob and say, oh, it's stretched by this much, and that's the direct shear.
Right.
In this regime, you can. It's harder to do that, so instead you use this quadratic estimator game.
Right. But one thing that you don't have to assume Gaussianity that, in that case, is just...
That's
the only thing is you assume, I guess, isotropy, or at least the fact that there's no correlation between electricity and galaxies, which is... So yeah, I'm just thinking that maybe there's a way that, since you are getting dominated, kind of killed by these nonlinear effects, then maybe there's a different angle that could help, which is very nonlinear objects like galaxies, that's what you do, right?
Yeah, so I guess if you were looking at blobs in the intensity map, and you knew that the blobs were circular on average, and you had a really strict definition of what a blob is, then you could try and measure the shearings of these blobs, but then probably like the shear field would vary over the scale of the blob, which is a key thing that you don't have happening in galaxy lensing, so then it's it gets a little tougher, but something like that might be possible.
Okay, well, let's thank Simon again.